Thank you so much for chatting with me.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
That was Richard Blanco, author of the memoir, The Prince of Los Cocuyos, A Miami Childhood. We also featured sounds from the Chicago Humanities Festival and from the PBS NewsHour, and music by Cuban rap artists, Orishas. That's it for Stage and Studio. If you missed any of this show, visit stageandstudio.org. You can also download shows at iTunes, and don't forget to like us on facebook.com/stage-studio. Or tweet us at @StageNStudio. I'm Sarika Mehta, sitting in for DMA Roberts. Thanks for listening.
Do you worry that corporate power is totally out of control? Tune into the KBOO Evening News every Tuesday evening at 5 p.m. beginning August 5th. To hear the new weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. I'll be sharing stories about communities that are rising up against corporate control and passing laws that exercise their right to govern themselves. That's every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News, beginning August 5th. Don't miss it.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Tucci Ristorante, an Italian dining house honoring the memory of Mary Cipolla Matucci and the spirit of the Lido restaurant in which she worked for 50 years. Tucci Ristorante features sustainable Northwest ingredients, drinks in the Lido bar, and is open every day in downtown Lake Oswego. Information at tucci.biz. That's TUCCI.BIZ. Andy Warhol looks a scream.
I'm Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Steve Graff. He's a curator of art at the Mary Hill Museum of Art near Goldendale, Washington. And he's here to talk about the new season. Thanks for coming into KBOO, Steve.
Thanks for inviting me. I'm happy to be here.
Mary Hill, people probably know it as that museum at sort of halfway down the gorge. It's about an hour and a half from Portland. And your season runs like March through the end of the year, is that right?
March 15th to November 15th.
Yeah. So just tell us what's new this season.
We have several changing exhibits this year. Foremost is an exhibit called American Indian Painting, 20th Century Masters, that we've borrowed from the National Cowboy and Western Heritage Museum in Oklahoma City. And it's about 35, 40 paintings by some pretty important easel painters up to about 1980, who lived in Oklahoma in the Southwest. And it's work that really isn't shown that much here in the Pacific Northwest. It's a kind of a Southwestern, Southern Plains thing. We have an exhibit of photographs by Sam Hill, who built the Mary Hill Museum structure, that are from his personal collection that chronicle the construction of the Columbia River Highway. So it's photos from 1912 to about 1916. And then we have some glass art by a Washington State glass artist named Raven Skyriver, whose sort of signature work is marine life worked in glass. He's actually a young man who does tremendous work. There's a wonderful YouTube video showing the process called Raven Skyriver, A Passion for the Process. In fact, we're showing that in our gallery right now.
The American Indian paintings, they have their own space. This is a traveling show, right?
Well, it's actually only traveling to us. I used to work at the National Cowboy Museum. I know the paintings. They have a large collection of American Indian painting. I knew this work. In fact, when I was working there, Mary Hill talked with me about bringing a show up, and we never got around to it. That was almost 10 years ago. So finally, it's here now.
Mm-hmm. And what is it about, you know, why is it different from the native painting you might find it everywhere?
Well, the sort of status quo for Indian education in this country up until about 1930 was to repress all celebrations of Native culture. And beginning in the 30s, there began to be a process of allowing Indian kids to make art and to reflect on the places where they lived, the celebrations where they lived, and show those in painting. So we have, by and large, Pueblo painting shows a lot of ceremonial activity. Navajo painting shows horses and weaving and things going on in a real arid landscape. And then the Oklahoma painting shows both Southern Plains and Southeastern culture in action. So there's some certain stylistic differences, and there's also some subject differences.
The education they were getting, this was in art school rather than just regular school, is that right?
Yeah, in fact, the education primarily began at the Santa Fe Indian School. There were special art classes at the University of Oklahoma, and there was a Baptist-run institution in eastern Oklahoma called Bacone College. And those tend to be the three sort of spheres within which most of the 20th century Indian painters worked, again, up until the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And in 1962, the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe was founded. And that was really the first time that Indian students were allowed to learn about mainstream art, because up to that time, because of sort of a romantic tendency on the part of the Indian educators and an awareness of the market, they didn't want painters to use perspective or shadow, no foreshortening, no ground line, any of this stuff. They just kind of wanted these figures floating in space because in their mind that was how Indians painted, based on some historical prototypes. And happily, after 1962, when Fritz Schulder began teaching painting at the Institute of American Indian Art, a lot of American Indian painting came much more into the mainstream where it is now.
So were native painters then, did they start painting like all other painters in the 60s and 70s, you know, political art, and whatever media was fashionable?
Yeah, absolutely, because you think about the 60s, the advent of the civil rights movement, AIM, the American Indian movement, much more political expression. It was just a very different time.
So the paintings on view are, they are mainly figures, animals, they're traditional in that sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And they show genre scenes of Indian life, ceremonial activity, sort of the stereotypical Indian activity we think about when we think about the plains in the Southwest.
Hmm. The young artist, the young glass artist, Raven Sky River, he's from somewhere in the Puget Sound?
Yeah, he's from up in the San Juans. He grew up in the San Juans and began working in glass at age 17, studied some in Venice, and then worked with William Morris, the famous glass artist. And then he has a really excellent team that he works with, because obviously glass is a team effort. Maybe people don't know that. Again, the YouTube video, Raven Sky River, A Passion for the Process, if you go there, you'll see he's working with five or six people, because it takes that many people to really get the job done.
And that video is on in the gallery, right?
And it's on in the gallery, yeah.
Yeah, so he does credit his team all the
time,
because you can't just poke a bit of glass in a fire and start blowing.
No, not at all.
And his work is glass animals, which is kind of the dreaded, you know, folk art of the coast. And you think, oh, no, but the way he does it is just extraordinary.
It really is. It could run the danger of being cute, but it's not. Of course, he's, having grown up in the San Juans, pretty concerned about the survival of the ocean ecosystems. And that's really one of the focuses of why he does what he does.
Mm-hmm. So you see, in your gallery, you have a whale.
Two whales.
By him?
By him, a flounder and a salmon, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, one of the things is, you know, he's a working artist, and it's a pretty considerable investment in his time to make art. And if we would have, you know, destroyed his inventory, we wouldn't have been doing him any favors. So it's limited to four pieces, but they really do seem to kind of be floating in space there.
Mm-hmm. So they're on loan to the gallery.
They're on loan for 8 months.
Right. And in the video, they show him making a seal, I think.
A sea lion, yeah.
Sea lion, where he's attaching the fins and putting a kind of smile on its face.
Yeah.
It's kind of amazing.
He had a lot of work that I would like to buy, but is actually too big for our cases. He does a lot of, he's done otters, octopus, other things, and some of those are actually longer than 4 feet, so we couldn't fit him in our cases. Mm-hmm.
And what's the name of that gallery? The sort of down slope from the main house.
That's the Laura and John Cheney Gallery, and that's sort of the connecting, the space that connects the historic building to the building that was completed in 2012.
If you can picture this out there, it's a beautiful light-filled room. You know, it's all white. It just feels like a gallery, whereas the museum feels like a museum.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other exhibits is about the Columbia River Highway. So Sam Hill took a lot of pictures?
Sam Hill actually had a photographer take a lot of pictures. And Sam Hill was really one of the big movers and shakers in public transportation in the Northwest in the teens, and actually before, after 1900. He's responsible pretty much for encouraging the Washington State Legislature to create the Washington Transportation Department. Mary Hill Museum owns more than 5,000 acres that was part of an agricultural community that Sam Hill had wanted to create where the museum is now. And after about 1910, he just took it upon himself to build some experimental paved roads. The first paved road in Washington State is there.
Where does that go?
Pretty much nowhere. It goes up the hill towards Goldendale. Its main claim to fame right now is that it's home to the Maryhill Festival of Speed, which is an International Gravity Sports Association World Cup site, in fact, the only one in North America. And the longboarders really do like having 3 miles of downhill.
Skateboarders?
Yeah. It'll be about the last week in June.
Oh, wow.
And it's really something, because they get going, you know, three and a half miles in a long downhill with a lot of curves. It's pretty fun to watch. And, you know, when you're on YouTube, look up Maryhill Festival of Speed, and you'll see what I'm talking about. But at one point, shortly after 1910, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the year, Sam Hill brought a bunch of pretty much the entire Oregon State Legislature out to see his roads.
Mm-hmm. And how did they get out there?
They went up to Vancouver, and they got on a train, and they went out and made a day of it and came back. And the good news was they then created an Oregon Highway Department, and the bad news was they didn't fund it. But that was part of the impetus for the Columbia River Highway. Sam actually had wanted it to be on the Washington side. Washington just didn't go for it. And ultimately, the part we're most familiar with, Crown Point to Multnomah Falls, Multnomah County actually had a lot to do with getting that section of highway built. But Sam had a photographer who was out there quite a lot and took photos and, you know, lovely, nice 8x10 glass negatives, so mm-hmm. we get really crisp prints.
These are pictures of guys in flat caps, like, digging rock by hand.
Some, and that's the amazing thing, is that highway was initially built pretty much by hand. Not much machinery was available to do the work.
Mm-hmm. Everyone knows this road. It's the windy road that takes you up to Crown Point. It parallels the freeway, and it's still in use today. What was Hill's transportation? What is he driving?
Well, the cars that are in the photos are, you know, I don't know my Model A's from my Model T's, but they were convertible cars, small cars, and they were just... There's a whole series of photos where he was out with one group of people, and then he'd go out with another group of people. And happily, actually for us, in the Northwest, one of those groups of people was the man who was the head of the U.S. Forest Service and the assistant forester, and they did a trip that actually went out the Columbia River Highway to Hood River, up over Mont Hood, and then back to Portland. It was an early incarnation of the Mont Hood Loop Highway. And when he got back to Portland, he announced that the Forest Service was going to donate all of the property adjacent to the Columbia River Highway to create a visual buffer.
Wow.
Which is wonderful.
They were thinking like that back then?
Yeah, they were thinking like that back then. And actually, Sam's point of view on the highway was, you know, we make a small investment in building the roads, and then we reap a huge investment in tourist dollars, in we're essentially investing in the scenery.
Mm-hmm. But was the road built so that the wealthy people who had cars had somewhere to go, somewhere nice to go?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely, because you think 1915, 1916, the graveled portion of the road at its western end, at the Portland end, was essentially finished 100 years ago, but it wasn't paved until 1916. So the centennial celebration will be next year. And of course, one of the things, too, that we don't have now, we have the Multnomah Falls Lodge. There was a period of time when there were roadhouses every couple of miles so that people had places to stay and nice restaurants to eat, and they had bathrooms that they could use. Mm-hmm.
Roadhouses, you mean for car drivers or horse and cart people?
You know, for car drivers, just like we have a photo of one, but they're pretty much from Crown Point all the way to Multnomah Falls. There was probably a half a dozen places at one time where you could stop and eat and spend the night if you wanted.
Right. Was there a railway along that side?
Yeah, and the railway was part of the problem because the railway was close enough to the foot of the hills that they didn't always have a real wide right-of-way within which to work, and the railroad has moved a little closer to the river in some places now so that there is a little bit of wiggle room. Oneonta Gorge being a classic, they've reopened the historic tunnel at Oneonta Gorge, and the railroad really used to be right up against that bluff, and it's moved a little towards the river, so the existing Columbia River Highway can skirt the bluff now.
Mm-hmm. The Maryhill Museum of Art, you go in, and the first thing you see is a bunch of furniture,
A bunch of gold furniture from the Romanian royal palaces.
Mm-hmm.
The museum, we generally say that the museum has had four founders, Sam Hill, Loie Fuller, Queen Marie of Romania, and Alma Spreckles from San Francisco. They all gave collections that are part of the founding collections. As you come in, you have all of this furniture from Romania, which makes sense in the context of the story, but maybe not so much sense if you're coming in cold and you're scratching your head. And
right. Some people are coming in quite warm from the vineyard
and the
winery next door.
Yeah, that's truly they
so,
are. Yeah.
You took me down into the stacks where there are things, the storage place, which is climate controlled and very modern now. And there are more Romanian textiles.
Yeah, in fact, next year we're only going to do a single large changing exhibit, and it will be on Romanian folk textiles. We have about 200. We're being given about 110 more from a Willamette Valley collection. And so this is a good opportunity to show it off. The donors are academics who've made more than a dozen formal research trips to Romania. And so it allows us, in the context of that exhibit, to talk about identity, village to village to village to village. And, of course, anybody who knows anything about Guatemala knows that huipils identify a person by village. And for us, it's nice because we have a very interesting collection of mid-20th century French high fashion. We have Native American clothing, and this is going to allow us in our overall educational offering to talk to young people about identity and clothing and how what you wear communicates about you and what you see on others tells you about them.
Mm-hmm. My name is Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Steve Graff. He's the curator of art at the Maryhill Museum of Art near Goldendale, Washington. Steve, what do you listen to music-wise?
Well, usually whatever I can get away with my office mate. But when I'm in the galleries, I've been sort of revisiting the 90s, 80s and 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And actually the thing that's kind of captivated me lately, and it's a little later than that, is some of the recent work by Mark Knopfler and Emmylou Harris.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically, the song that comes to mind is the title track from their All the Road Running LP from maybe 5 years ago.
Let's give it a listen.
A million miles our vagabond wheels clocked up beneath the clouds. They're counting down to showtime when we do it for real with the crowds. Their miles are owing, but they don't come for free, and they don't give you any for pain. But if it's all for nothing, all the road running's been in vain.
shots come down like cannon fire and thunder all for war. There's a man in every corner, and each one is given his own. This is my pipe, this is my drum, so you never will hear me complain. And if it's all
to go up on the wall, it can only be fast and high. And those who don't like the danger soon find something different to try. And when there is only a ring in your ears and an echo down memory lane, and if it's all
that was All the Road Running by Mark Knopfler and Emmylou Harris. That's old Dire Straits Knopfler, right?
Yep.
What do you like about that?
I'm terrible at remembering song lyrics, but the opening lyric talks about them traveling a million miles under vagabond skies. And so it's just kind of got that road trip vibe there at the beginning. And when I'm working in the galleries, I'd much rather be on a road trip somewhere else. Mm-hmm. But
that's the extraordinary thing about where you work. I mean, the museum is perched on a hill, and it's everywhere you look is sort of, it's not wilderness, but it's bare mountains.
It's not at the end of the world, but you can see the end of the world from there. I mean, it feels like that. We have a 180 view of the Columbia River to the south. You know, we see as far as Maryhill Winery to the west. We see as far as John Day Dam to the east, and all the river in between. And then in the other direction, it's hills, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But people come out for the day, right, from the Portland area.
Well, I hope they do. They should, because it's kind of the perfect day trip. It's an hour and a half or 2 hours out, almost from Troutdale to Maryhill Winery. All of it's in the Columbia Gorge National Scenic Area. We're within 15 miles. There's probably 5 tasting rooms. We have an outdoor sculpture garden. We have picnic tables. A lot of the times, particularly in the spring when it's wet here in Portland, we have sunny 60-degree, 70-degree days. There's a live video cam at Maryhill Winery you can check if you're concerned.
Mm-hmm.
The gorge doesn't really end at Hood River. I know a lot of people think it might, but the eastern end of the gorge is really nice because it's really arid and pretty mild. We also have a circa 1918 faux Stonehenge.
On the eastern end of the gorge. I played hide and seek there with my kids.
Yeah, absolutely. And the Maryhill Loops, which is the original paved road in Washington, has a gate at the bottom so that cars can't drive up it randomly, but hikers and bicyclists are always welcome to go up and down. It's just about exactly across the road from the turnoff to Stonehenge.
That's a hiking trail.
Hiking trail, biking trail. And if you want to walk to the top, it's a skateboarding trail too.
The rest of the museum, as you go up the stairs, is one little kind of cubby, kind of glassed in, and it has a bunch of busts in, you know, Tolstoy and Ben Franklin and somebody's heroes made of plastic.
Yeah, those were donated by some Paris museum or another back when the museum was getting founded, and they're pretty much all copies of more famous works.
Were they one person's favorites, or did they just somebody else?
I think it was just a donation of extras that got sent off to America.
Mm-hmm. And so the museum evolves, I guess it evolves in kind of lurches, depending on who gives you something that you like.
Yeah, the museum was originally conceived as being a museum of just specifically French fine art, because Louis Fuller was a big fan of Rodin and was trying to get her American friends to buy Rodin works. And we have about 80 Rodins, which it's not the largest in the country or even the largest on the West Coast, but it's still pretty significant. And many of ours actually came from Sam Hill's estate. He had purchased them. He hadn't purchased them. He had paid off a Loewy Fuller had used them as collateral, and he had paid off the loan, and so he then owned them. And so the big art collections we got, oddly enough, from Samuel were the Rodins and American Indian Basket collection of about 80 baskets. And then Queen Marie, when she came to the dedication in 1926, brought a number of things, mostly related to the Romanian royal family, and a gift of some Iron Age ceramics from one of her daughters, who was the Queen of Greece. So the ceramics are from Cyprus. And then another daughter, who was Queen of Yugoslavia, sent some wonderful silver filigree work. And then Alma Spreckels outlived everybody else. And from her, the museum received some really interesting fine and decorative arts, mostly European, including a wonderful small collection of Art Nouveau art glass, original works by Emile Gallet and others of that time period. And she purchased over the years a number of things from Queen Marie because she wanted to create a Romanian room in one of the San Francisco museums, and when that didn't happen, that material all came to Mary. Mm-hmm.
The mannequins with the French fashion on, they're one of those odd things you see and you never forget.
And actually, those also came from Alma Spreckels. Mm-hmm. The collection is called the Teatro della Mode, and it's 27-inch tall mannequins modeling the 1945 and 1946 Paris runway shows.
So this was real clothing that was copied in miniature and then taken on the road to sort of publicize French fashion.
Absolutely. The French fashion industry was trying to get started right after the war, kind of gear back up. It was clothing, shoes, all the accessories, shoes, hats, handbags. It toured Europe. It then went to New York and San Francisco. And then at the end of that time, it did not go back to Paris because the fashion houses didn't want to pay the duty. They took the jewelry back because it was real diamonds and real rubies. But it stayed in the City of Paris department store in San Francisco for a couple of years. Alma Spreckels convinced everybody involved to send it to Maryhill. It was rediscovered in 1990, went back to Paris, was restored. Parts of it have toured. We have three sets out now, and we try to rotate those every 2 years. And ultimately, we want to move them into a permanent display where we can have all nine of them out at the same time.
Do you have room for that?
Eventually, we will.
Oh, you can add on?
No, that will go where the permanent Native American exhibit is in that rotunda downstairs, and then Native American stuff will come upstairs into a square room. Other collections that we feature that came from the four founders, I mentioned that Sam Hill gave us the original donation of American Indian baskets. We have a pretty large permanent exhibit of American Indian material. We're always interested in adding to it, and we're specifically interested in adding to it in stuff that's region-specific. And I was just told the middle of this week that we're going to receive a very nice donation of Middle Columbia River area baskets and beadwork, which will supplement what we already have. And we're also in the process of, over several years, getting a donation of some Arctic material. We have a nice display of turn of the 20th century Arctic material, and this is from 1970s out in western Alaska. It's kind of exciting to be able to compare the two because there's some overlap in the material.
And just briefly, I mean, what else is coming up in the future for the museum?
Well, we're actually, as of just a couple of days ago, going to begin the reinstallation of our permanent chess set collection. And it's all going to move from where it is now into the new building in the downstairs. And I just started putting pencil to paper to figure out how we're going to do it.
So you have hundreds of boxes with chess sets.
We have 300 chess sets. We have 75 out now, and we'll probably end up somewhere with 75 to 100 of them out in the new installation. And obviously, they're not all fantastic. So we really just try to show the really, really wonderful ones, and over time acquire more really wonderful ones.
Mm-hmm. And do you have any kind of digital archive or anything that people can access from here?
Right now, the best thing people can do is go to the Google Art Project at the Google Cultural Institute website, and if they plug in Maryhill Museum of Art, they'll get 80 pretty high-resolution photos of things from the collection. And certainly, I tried to include something from all of the categories we've talked about today, just to see. We have about 8 major collecting areas, and so it's, you know, it allows people to see kind of what we have.
How does that work? I mean, Google made that. Do you make the choices, or do Google have a say?
No, Google basically arranges with the museum to participate, and then we supply the images, and we supply all the interpretive data, and we give it to them on a spreadsheet and in a file, and it just goes up all formatted and ready to go.
Does any money change hands?
None. No. And the wonderful thing is there's about, I don't know, 300, in the neighborhood of 300 different art museums on that website right now. And so if you're interested in a certain artist, you can search by the name, and maybe 3-4 different works from 3-4 different museums will show up, especially the better known artists.
My guest this week was Steve Graff. He's the curator of art at the Maryhill Museum of Art in the Gorge. The museum just started its new season.
75th season.
75th season, which runs through the end of the year. And it's well worth a visit. Thanks for coming in, Steve.
My real pleasure. Thank you.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland.
Andy Warhol looks a scream, hanging on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell him apart at all. Andy Warhol looks a scream.
KBOO and the Quinta Street Theater are proud to present a music documentary that raises the bar for the genre. Arrows into Infinity, the new documentary about the life of jazz musician Charles Lloyd. Thursday, April 9 at the Quinta Street Theater. Arrows into Infinity takes us on Lloyd's journey from the heights of jazz rock royalty to his life in seclusion and back again. Arrows into Infinity, the Portland premiere, Thursday, April 9, 7 p.m. at the Quinta Street Theater. 2522 Southeast Clinton, Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.